This is number 0060, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0060. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we'll have another visit with Mark Abrams. We talk to him once a year from the Annals of Improbable Research. They put out the Ig Nobel Prizes, and the prestige continues for the Ig Nobel Prizes. You know, this year, one of their previous winners actually won a Nobel Prize.
His name is Andre Geim. He's Russian, Dutch, British. Started out in Russia, moved to Holland, and has been working in England for the last, I think, about 10 years. About 10 years ago, exactly 10 years ago, we awarded him the Ig Nobel Physics Prize. He and another scientist together had used magnets to levitate a frog. This week, he got a telephone call from Sweden, from the Nobel Committee, informing him that he has just won this year's Nobel Prize in Physics.
Paul Johnson is a national television reporter who has also written a novel set in Afghanistan about a television reporter, a job he has actually done. Is there a lot of him in the character of his novel?
Well, that's the big question, and I've had several people ask me, including my wife, because there's a lot of illicit behavior, let's say, in the book. You know, hey, what's this about? Is there something you're not telling me here about your trips to Afghanistan? I said, rest assured, it is fiction. The protagonist of the novel is also a TV journalist who happens to have a drug problem, happens to have some rather strange sexual proclivities. These, again, are made up. But this intersection between, you know, my life and the things that I saw when I was reporting in Afghanistan and what the protagonist of this novel is doing, you know, I think that really stems from one of the things that, you know, any writer will tell you, especially some of their first work that they're doing, is that you write what you know.
Composer Charles Fox, who has written his memoirs entitled Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. How did writing his memoirs come to be?
It came about as a result of finding letters in my mother's apartment that I had written when I was a student. While I was 18, 19, 20 years old, I lived in Paris. I was very fortunate at a young age to get to study with extraordinary teacher Nadia Boulanger, who was Aaron Copland's teacher 40 years before me. While I was there, I wrote all these letters home. I couldn't afford to. I had no telephone, couldn't afford to make a phone call. So I wrote extensive letters home about my life in Paris. Someone referred to it as Paris in black and white, you know, 1959, 1960. When we found these letters in my mother's drawer that was hidden probably for 40 years, it sort of opened the portal back to my early years.
And of course, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0060, is Elias Makos, who is a technology and trends columnist and a friend. You can check out his website at eliasmakos.com. And thank you very much, Elias, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And we start off with a story from Arizona. An Arizona woman accidentally glued an eye shut when she mistook super glue for her eye drops. Imgard Holm of Glendale had cataract surgery a year ago. She was reaching for what she thought was one of her half dozen eye drop medications. The burning sensation told her immediately something was seriously wrong. Holmes said the eye drops and the superglue bottles are nearly identical. My question is, why would her superglue bottle be anywhere near her eye drops medication? That just doesn't make sense to begin with. Anyway, after putting superglue in her eye, Holmes said she tried washing it out, but the quick drying substance did what it was supposed to do and sealed her eye shut. Holmes got to the hospital and staff cut off the hardened glue covering her eye. Once the eye was opened, doctors washed it out to prevent any major damage. Okay, moving right along, after being pulled over for alleged drunk driving in Orland Park, Illinois, Cheryl A. Erzdowski, age 38, walked a straight line for police. Then she walked up and down the line with hands on her hips three additional times, the resulting police report notes, like a model. That was after police said no thanks to her offer to perform a gymnastics maneuver. When told she was under arrest, Cheryl demanded that the officer read her the Amanda rights. Yes, you heard me right. The Amanda rights. Wow. You have the right to be blonde. If you wish to be blonde and cannot afford to be one, peroxide will be provided to you without a charge. Do you understand your Amanda rights as I have explained them to you? Moving right along, you know how we love truck spills on this show, and this isn't quite a truck spill, but it's a truck with issues. This is from Glendale, California. A burning big rig loaded with yams has caused a hot potato of a traffic problem on a Los Angeles freeway. California Highway Patrol Officer Ed Jacobs said the tractor trailer hauling 50,000 pounds of the sweet potatoes caught fire on the southbound Interstate 5 in Glendale at about 2:30 a.m. No injuries were reported, but two of the four southbound lanes were closed for about 7.5 hours, slowing traffic until the yams could be loaded into another truck. What was left of the yams after the fire to load them into another truck? That's what I'd like to know. Anyway, moving right along, the public library in Belcherton, Massachusetts has banned Lord Jesus Christ. No, not the Bible, but a guy named Lord Jesus Christ III, a local artist who allegedly changed his name because he said God told him to. But librarians say Christ has been a nuisance at the library, cutting in line in front of other patrons to ask questions or ask to borrow scissors or whatever. He's very rude, the library's director, Owen Maloney, said. Christ, who is 50, says it's discrimination. I'm black, I'm transsexual, and my name is Lord Jesus Christ, he says, as if that's enough to show bias. Maloney says it was a very big step to ban anyone. Lord Jesus Christ is the first person ever to be banned, and I suppose I'm going to burn in hell because of it. His words, not mine. On to Indianapolis. I mentioned truck spills before. This is a truck spill of sorts. Money doesn't grow on trees, but it seems to fall from the sky in Indianapolis. Police said three bundles of money fell off the back of an armored car near the intersection in the heart of downtown Indianapolis. A car hit one of the bundles and sent bills blowing into the breeze. Witnesses told the Indianapolis Star about 10 people stormed through traffic into the intersection to fill their arms with cash. These are the people who are going straight to hell, by the way. Two others stopped to help collect the money and guard it until police and the armored car company arrived. It's not immediately known how much money went missing, but most of the blown cash was recovered. Nice to know there's some honest people out there. That's all I'm saying. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest. After a man crashed his SUV into the front of a strip club in Madison, Wisconsin, police asked him if he was okay. He said, not good, reported police spokesman Joel Despain, but he added that he had seen some nice strippers. Keith Rasmussen, age 50, had been thrown out of the club by bouncers and allegedly drove into the building on purpose. Then it gets weird. Police found him 9 blocks away, but Rasmussen denied driving the SUV to that location. He said he arrived there with the help of Martians. Rasmussen, who is from Racine, told police he came to Madison to murder his sister. When asked how, he told officers to look in his car. They found a large knife. He has been charged with driving while intoxicated, reckless driving, hit and run, reckless endangerment, disorderly conduct, and criminal damage to property, and released after posting $2,800 bail. The last part is the part that surprises me the most. This guy had a large knife in his car and claims he's going to kill his sister. He was released on bail. But hey, don't worry. If he kills his sister, they'll probably increase his bail. Wow. That is odd. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? With us is Mark Abrams. We have him on the show each year. He's with the Annals of Improbable Research, and they annually have the Ig Nobel Awards. Who are the big winners this year? Well, let's find out. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Peter.
Thanks for being back on the show with us. You had the awards this year, and what I find very interesting is you actually have someone who won a past Ig Nobel Prize, who this year won an actual Nobel Prize?
Yeah, his name is Andrei Geim. He's Russian-Dutch British, started out in Russia, moved to Holland, and has been working in England for the last, I think, about 10 years. About 10 years ago, exactly 10 years ago, we awarded him the Ig Nobel Physics Prize. He and another scientist together had used magnets to levitate a frog. There are videos of this all over the internet, which are pretty entrancing.
Yeah.
And this week, yesterday, in fact, he got a telephone call from Sweden, from the Nobel Committee, informing him that he has just won this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. He and another scientist did some work with a substance called graphene, which is the stuff that's on the end of your pencil. You know, the stuff they call lead, it's actually a form of carbon. And it's opening up possibly gigantic new doors in science and technology. So he's very much a Renaissance man.
So I guess you're relieved to know that winning an Ig Nobel does not in any way, shape, or form preclude you from winning an actual Nobel Prize. On the other side of the coin...
Yeah, and I should mention that probably about a third of the people who win Ig Nobel Prizes are concerned about that and have been asking us, will this prevent me from winning a Nobel? So now we know, no, it does not necessarily prevent you from winning a Nobel Prize.
You could actually say to them now that this could open the door to an actual Nobel Prize.
Well, I suppose it could.
So let's talk a little bit about this year's winners. I understand they include things like whale snot and bat sex.
Yeah, you know, as you phrase it, it occurs to me there are not all that many things like whale snot and bat sex. They pretty much stand on their own, each of them. This was the 20th time we've given the prizes. It's the 20th set of winners. The prize in engineering went to a team of three people in England and Mexico who perfected a new method for collecting whale snot. They do it using a remote control helicopter.
And one needs to ask, why does one want to collect whale snot?
You don't have to ask them. To them, it's self-evident. They're scientists. They study whales and other animals who live in the sea. And, you know, just as when you go to the doctor, a doctor might want to take swabs from your mouth and maybe even from your nose, because they can then look at that and measure all sorts of things about your health. Same thing with the whales. The blowhole is, you know, in a certain way equivalent to your nose, and the stuff that comes out is it's snot. And whales are really big, and people are really small compared to them, and it's not so easy to take a little sample.
We're having a little fun with this, but in reality, basically, they're studying respiratory diseases in whales. Is that correct?
Yeah, lots and lots of things about whales, starting with that, yeah. And remote control helicopters, so far, that's the state of the art for getting those things.
Okay, so I did touch on the bat sex, so you have to explain that one.
Yeah, you'll want to go back and rephrase that, won't you?
Yeah.
we gave this year's Ig Nobel Biology Prize to a team of scientists in China and England who scientifically documented fellatio in fruit bats.
And again, the reason they do this is, I'm sure there's a deeper scientific reason for it.
Well, they were studying fruit bats, and they noticed this phenomenon that nobody had mentioned or probably even thought about or dreamed about, and now they have films of it. So now science can, if science chooses to, try to figure out the details of what's going on and why. The now, how is pretty clear.
Now, a scientist...
As you touched on.
Yeah. A scientist has discovered that people slip and fall less on ice when they wear socks on the outside of their shoes.
Yeah, this is three people in New Zealand in a city called Dunedin, which has nasty winters and very steep hills in the city. And there's a tradition going way back there of people who live in those parts of the city putting on socks on the outside of their shoes, and they say that this keeps them from slipping nearly so much. So these doctors tested it. They went to the steepest hills, and one morning while people were walking to work, and they asked some of them to put socks on over their shoes and others not to, and then they watched what happened, and they found the people with socks on the outside slipped and fell a lot less. Now, since they've won their prize, which is just last week, they and we have heard from people in many other parts of the world saying, hey, it's not fair for them to take credit for this because, you know, we here in wherever it is have been doing this for generations. And one of the places was the Netherlands, which is very, very flat but has ice in the winter. Even there, there have been people doing it for a long time. Now there is some scientific evidence that it really is the best way to go about in the winter.
Well, the thing that I find interesting is usually a lot of the people who are in the running for Ig Nobel Prizes or have won Ig Nobel Prizes gain notoriety because of their connection to the Ig Nobel. But there's one I've seen here now out of your list. I actually remember hearing a lot about on its own, and that is the colleagues in Britain who confirmed that swearing relieves pain.
Yeah, you may have done some research of your own on this. They published a paper, Richard Stevens and two of his students at Keele University in England, that their experiments, they say, show that there's a lot of truth to the idea that if you swear, and you've got to be swearing with words that really mean something to you personally, when you experience pain, that the pain doesn't cause you to suffer so much.
Wow. And so that one gets the Ig Nobel Peace Prize, correct?
Yeah, of course.
What I find fascinating is as time has gone on, and you say this is the 20th year, you have actual Nobel Prize winners who give out the awards, and the people who receive the awards are very, very appreciative. It's you often hear about scientists and science, and the one thing you don't hear about is them having a sense of humor. This is clearly not the case. Obviously, they do.
Yeah, almost every scientist does, but you know, there have been a lot of forces at work in that profession to, I guess most professions have their ways of doing things, and the tradition has been to appear in public to be very, very somber all the time, as if you don't enjoy anything, whereas most scientists really do seem to love what they're doing, even though it's a pretty frustrating line of work, and a lot of them can be kind of playful, but you know, they sometimes disguise that.
Having said that, after 20 years of giving out these awards, are there still some parts of the scientific community that aren't giving you the love you deserve?
You can take any group of people, and here and there will be some that just don't like what other people are doing, especially if other people seem to be having a good time. So, you know, these people have a good time by disapproving, but there really don't seem to be many people. You know, the Ig Nobels, I think the highest and greatest thing you can say about us is we're pretty harmless.
Now, people can go to the website and see part, if not all, of the ceremonies that you had to offer, the recent Ig Nobel Prize.
Yeah, we webcast it live over YouTube, and we're just getting that edited. And sometime in the next day or so, we should get the recorded version up there. So if you just go to improbable.com. If it's not there when you get there, just come back in a day and it will be. And you can see all of this year's winners, and a number of the past winners came back this year too, including Dr. Elena Bodnar, who won a prize last year. You may remember she invented the brassiere that in an emergency can be quickly converted into a pair of protective face masks. And she came back this year to announce that it's now available for sale to the public. And she gave bras to the five Nobel laureates who were on stage and had them demonstrate. Also, a writer named Neil Gaiman, who you may know, was there, and he helped demonstrate also by putting a bra over his face.
When the bra actually does go for sale, will the packaging state created by the winner of the Ig Nobel Award?
You know, I haven't seen the packaging. I've just seen the bra.
If I had $1 million for every time I heard that statement.
And, well, maybe you will. It's a, as Dr. Bodnar likes to point out, it's a lovely piece of lingerie.
Mm. Mark, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. People can check out the website, which is improbable.com. Thanks for being on, and congratulations for another great year of the Ig Nobel Awards.
Thanks, Peter. I'm always honored to be on your program.
Mark Abrams from the Annals of Improbable Research. They are the folks who put out the annual Ig Nobel Awards. And you can find out more information by going to their website at improbable.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0060, and you'll find the links to their site.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Paul Johnson, who is a television reporter, also the author of The Pashtun Fixer. And we'll meet Charles Fox, who is a composer and author of the book Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. And you know, Charles Fox has been responsible for a lot of music that you recognize, especially on television, including the theme music you just heard in our bumper. If you know your television, you know that was Wide World of Sports, and you'll hear a little bit of what Charles has to say about his work as a composer and other things coming up in a bit. But right now, we have more stuff right here, right now, when we take you to Taipei for our first story in this section of the Stuff File News. Frightened visitors at a Taiwanese theme park have repeatedly attacked actors dressed in ghost costumes in a haunted theater attraction. Now, the incidents have prompted the Janfusun Amusement Park to grant leave of absence or transfer for actors who worked at Horrorwood, which features scenes from 10 classic horror movies. A male employee in a zombie costume was slapped in the face by a man whose girlfriend had been scared out of her wits. The man later explained he wanted to find out whether the ghost was real or not. These people don't read the signs on the wall at the amusement park. Just the word amusement should be a hint. But anyway, a female visitor hit another male worker in the private parts with an umbrella. One female employee complained that male visitors often touched her hip. So there you go. Now, we have a couple of stories before we get to our next guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, that are very similar in nature. The first one comes from Lockland, Ohio. Police in suburban Cincinnati arrested a woman after she flagged an officer down and asked if there were any warrants out for her arrest. After Lockland police officer Dan Lyons informed 44-year-old Selma Elmore she was indeed wanted and there was an outstanding warrant, the woman then ran off. The chase ended when Elmore pushed Lyons into a building, injuring his elbow. Other officers responding to the call for backup later apprehended the woman. Elmore, wanted for allegedly failing to pay a fine as a result of a drug conviction, now faces a charge of resisting arrest. And as I said, there are two stories like this, so here's the other very similar story. A Jefferson County, Alabama sheriff's deputy was getting gas at a service station when the motorist at the next pump walked over and asked if he had any warrants out for his arrest. Why are people doing this? I don't know. Sergeant Vanita Edge said she would check and warned him that if there were, she would arrest him. Matthew Kennard, age 27, handed over his driver's license and told her about his various prior arrests. Sure enough, the Check found a warrant for Kinnard on drug charges, and the deputy made good on her promise. As she was taking him to jail, Kinnard couldn't help but ask for one more, or at least make, rather, one more statement. He said, "I am the stupidest criminal in the world, aren't I?" Well, I guess, Matthew, you're at least in the top 90%. At least. And yet, believe it or not, Matthew didn't make this week's Idiot of the Day. And I guess one of the reasons is because he realizes his stupidity. Most people in Idiot of the Day never realize just how dumb they are. But that's coming up later on the program. Let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Paul Johnson is a television reporter on Global National here in Canada. Full disclosure, that's the same network I work for. Paul is the correspondent based in Washington, D.C. He is also the author of a novel entitled The Pashtun Fixer, a fictional story that deals with a reporter and has Afghanistan as a backdrop. Paul joins us on the line from Washington. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm well, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. As I mentioned, you're a reporter. You're a national reporter. You have worked for the network and covered places like Afghanistan. And you've written this fictional novel that deals with a reporter who works in Afghanistan. How much of you is in this book?
Well, that's the big question. And I've had several people ask me, including my wife, because there's a lot of illicit behavior, let's say, in the book. You know, hey, what's this about? Is there something you're not telling me here about your trips to Afghanistan? I said, rest assured, it is fiction, so it is made up. The protagonist of the novel is also a TV journalist who happens to have a drug problem, a bad one, and happens to have some rather strange sexual proclivities. These, again, are made up. Everybody's listening. You know, so, but this intersection between, you know, my life and the things that I saw when I was reporting in Afghanistan and what the protagonist of this novel is doing, a fellow called Matt Allison, you know, I think that really stems from one of the things that, you know, any writer will tell you, especially some of their first work that they're doing, is that you write what you know. Write in the vein and in the universe of something that you already know about. And I think that's a lot of what informed my writing here when I set out to write this novel, was that because I have been there and I have done this job, there is a kind of a richness of detail that more easily comes to you because you have seen it and you have experienced it. And I have to say, you know, I don't know about you, Peter, going out and reporting the news or working in the media industry, you know, you come across just a tremendous amount of different storylines and outcomes and things that you see and observe. You know, you were talking about your fondness for kicker stories, you know, the happy sort of quirky stories at the end of the newscast. And, you know, you process so many of these through your brain that, you know, after a while, at least for me, you can't help but saying, well, what if that story wasn't really this, it was that? What if it kind of ended up this way? What if there was a stranger came to town kind of an element that showed up in this true story? How would that story have played out differently? And that's sort of how I arrived at the storyline that you see in the Pashtun Fixer. It's a lot of things that I actually observed, and, you know, a lot of the details that you would see if you read the novel, you know, our actual observations of what it's like on the ground in southern Afghanistan in a massive NATO base where journalists work and interact with some of the local people. The storyline and the plot obviously is made up. Now, that's not to say these things could not happen. You know, this isn't really an example of magical realism or anything like that. But, you know, this is really a function of things that I saw and observed, and you know, with a writer and a storyteller's sort of flair put in there, and a lot of imagination and creativity. So, you know, to a long answer, that's how we arrived on this. It is made up, but the observations are real.
We often see on television or read in magazines reporters who go to war-torn areas and bring back the stories of how it affects the lives of the soldiers who are there fighting whatever particular battle it might be. You say you hang around with a lot of the journalists, especially when you go and you get embedded in such a way. Do you ever talk about how it affects the reporters?
You know, that's a good question. And I think that's something that more and more journalists are asking themselves. There was a fellow down here, an American reporter, who recently did a documentary about post-traumatic stress disorder that he suspects is affecting journalists. You know, I have to question that in myself, too. And you would know a bit about this, too, in our jobs. We go to a lot of bad places. We go to a lot of disasters. We meet and we interview and interact with a lot of people on the very worst day of their lives. And that psychic energy that you encounter when you meet them, you know, it doesn't leave you. And, you know, it stays with you.
So having said that, is writing the Pashtun Fixer a cathartic experience for you?
In some ways, I think it was. I don't feel as though, after having written the Pashtun Fixer, that I feel any less bad about some of the things that I experienced, either in Afghanistan or other places that I've been, in terms of the human suffering that I saw, Haiti, for instance, Bosnia. However, it does allow me to talk about ideas and concepts and observations that I had when being in these places that I couldn't get out in the form of a regular straight-up news report, which, you know, has to be relatively unbiased and not full of my opinions and observations and creativity. Do I feel any less bad about the human suffering that I've observed over the years? Probably not. Does it still live in me? Yes.
You are a Canadian living in the United States, working for a Canadian network who's gone to some of the horrible places in the world and seen some of the suffering. How does what you've seen as a reporter change your feelings about North America?
Well, I mean, I really had a collision with this question that you're putting to me earlier this year after the earthquake in Haiti. And I spent about 2 weeks on the ground there immediately after the earthquake. And we had this strange experience after we got out of Port-au-Prince. We'd been relieved and another crew from Global had been sent in. And the way that we got out of Port-au-Prince was because the airport was basically, you know, was shut down except for aid flights that were coming in. And so we drove overland to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. And the company, wanting to take care of us, had paid for a few nights in an all-inclusive resort outside of Santo Domingo. Very nice place, you know, a Caribbean beach resort. And just for us to rest and eat and, you know, try to not think about what we'd seen for a while. So, you know, we were there and, you know, of course, it was full of the packaged tourist deal crowd from a lot of Canadians and a lot of Americans. And I recall at one point sitting on the beach there, looking out over the beautiful turquoise water there, and hearing some of the complaints of some of the folks there talking about their concerns about their jobs at home. And one guy in particular was talking about a dispute he was having over a truck that he was leasing in Calgary. And, you know, and they were consumed with their problems back home. And I had just come from a place where I literally saw, you know, bodies piled up in the streets like cordwood, you know, and more than 250,000 people killed. And I thought to myself, we have no idea. Any of us living in North America who are fortunate enough to have been born in one of the modern, stable societies that exist on this planet, we really need to remind ourselves, no matter what is going on in our lives, every day when we get up, we won the lottery already. You know, as bad as it seems with the conflict with your boss or your ex-wife or your financial problem, the fact that we live in a modern society where the infrastructure works, where the police are mostly not corrupt, and where the ambulance will come and pick you up for the most part after you get hit by a car, thank yourself, thank fate, that you won the lottery. Yeah. So that was my feeling after coming out of Haiti.
We have just about a minute. I just want to talk a little bit about the fact that the book, The Pashtun Fixer, is available on Amazon.com for the Kindle, right?
Yes, it's available as a download for a Kindle. If you go to Amazon.com, search The Pashtun Fixer, it'll come up, and you can download it either as a Kindle or you can read it on your computer. If you're interested in Afghanistan, if you're interested in this very fascinating tribe that's really come to dominate what's been going on in that conflict over there, the Pashtun people whose traditional lands straddle the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, right where all of the conflict is, I think you really enjoy The Pashtun Fixer. It's about that. It's about those people. It's about the interesting tribal code of the Pashtuns. It's called Pashtun Wali. And it's about the journalists who cover it. And there's a lot of observation there in that novel that you probably won't see on the evening newscasts or in the newspapers, just because still, in my opinion, not enough time is devoted to Afghanistan, which really has become the signature conflict of the post 9/11 age. So if you're interested at all, it's a good fast read, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Paul, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Call me anytime, Peter. Enjoy your show.
Paul Johnson, the author of The Pashtun Fixer. You can check out Paul's website at pauljohnsonfilms.com. He also does documentary films. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0060, and you'll find links to Paul's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly for the Kindle. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones. What would you call a class action lawsuit that wound up giving each person who was part of the lawsuit an average award of less than a penny? And what would you call it if you learned that their lawyers got $1 million? I'd call it robbery. But it actually happened, and these kinds of class action lawsuits are happening every day in our country. In fact, there are so many frivolous lawsuits like this that the Center for Class Action Fairness can't keep up with all the requests it gets to help consumers who feel they're being ripped off by their own lawyers. Let's be fair, there are legitimate class action lawsuits. But the courts today are filled with speculative class action lawsuits that seek meaningless changes and which bring about meaningless awards for consumers. Plaintiff lawyers bully companies into settling these lawsuits for millions of dollars in fees because the companies know they'll have to pay their own lawyers more to fight the lawsuit. In too many cases, the lawyers get rich and the rest of us get nothing. Learn more about how class action lawsuits often hurt more people than they help. Go to our website at foundationforfairciviljustice.org.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Charles Fox, the composer who actually composed the song we're now hearing, Killing Me Softly. And, of course, we also have an idiot of the day. We'll get to that later. But we have time for one more Stuff File story. And we'll do it right here, right now. And we go all the way to New Zealand for this story. A drunk driver trapped after overturning his car cracked open another can of beer while he was waiting for emergency crews to rescue him, according to a New Zealand court. Paul Nigel Sneddon, age 47, pleaded guilty to careless driving and drunken driving after being nearly three times over the legal alcohol limit in a district court in the city of Palmerton North. Police found Sneddon, a former baker, trapped in his overturned Ford Laser on June the 1st, drinking a can of beer after he failed to take a corner properly and crashed through a wooden barrier, flipping his vehicle. Defense lawyer Peter Young said that when Snedden found he could not open the doors, he had nothing else to do at that point, so he had another beer. When asked by police how much he had consumed, Snedden replied, "Plenty. I've been drinking for 4 straight days." Snedden, who is estranged from his wife, gee, I wonder why, said that he went on a drinking binge after losing his job at a bakery on the same day that he heard his father was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Judge Gregory Ross fined him $1,100 and disqualified him from driving for 10 months. This was his first offense. I'm guessing, however, this was not necessarily his first offense, just the first time he was caught. Anyway, he doesn't make the idiot of the day. We'll get to that in a little bit, but right now, let's get to our next guest. And we have a very special guest for you on the Stuff File program. Charles Fox is a composer who is responsible for some of the best and most popular music from at least my generation. He has written such pop hits as Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly, but some of his most familiar music are the television theme songs he's composed. Here's a montage. Yes, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Love American Style, Wonder Woman, Love Boat, and even The Wide World of Sports, which we heard earlier, and also Monday Night Football, just to name a few. He has written his memoir entitled Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. Charles Fox joins us on the line right now. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Peter. How are you? Great to be on with you.
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. You know, I listed just some of the music you've done over the years, and you've now written your memoir. In looking back at your life and seeing what you've done to put this book together, does it sometimes surprise you how prolific you were and how prolific you are in your career?
You know, it's a funny thing, but in my career, in my life, I just take one project at a time as it comes. I have gone through periods of my life where I was so busy. I mean, there was a time when you mentioned some of the shows I had. One time, I had 6 or 7 television shows on the air at the same time. So I really didn't even stop thinking about what I was doing. I just was too busy doing my work. So the idea of being prolific really never even occurred to me. I was just busy on a day-to-day basis doing what I love to do. Just so simple.
And that's you bring up an interesting point because you say you have several shows on the air at the same time. People sometimes think you write the theme song and then you walk away. There's a lot to composing and scoring a television show. That's an ongoing project, correct?
That's true. Well, actually, the only show that I really did all the episodes was the first show that brought me out to Hollywood. That was Love American Style. That was on the air for 5 years, I think, and I really did literally all the episodes. But that really meant we used to do 22 episodes a year. They had me score half of them, or 11 episodes, and the other 11 were tracked by a very very talented music editor, using the same music in the other 11 episodes. And more than, you know, sometimes I've just done the theme, actually. And I, for example, believe it or not, with The Love Boat, which has carried my theme all these years, before there was a series, there was a movie called The Love Boat, and we did two or three of those. Then when it came on the air as a series, Aaron Spelling, well, I was talking with him, and I said, why don't we have a song? Because before that, it was just a main title theme. I said, it would be great for longevity of the show if we have lyrics added. So he thought that was a terrific idea, and I asked Paul Williams to write the lyric, and he wrote a wonderful lyric. And then when I came to Aaron's office to play it for him, he didn't have any way to play it. He didn't have a piano or a tape machine or a cassette machine. And we had a lot of 20th century guitars. I ended up just singing that song a cappella, snapping my fingers, like, love, exciting and new, come aboard, we'll welcome you. And anyway, that's how he got to hear it. But that, when it came on the air, I really did only the first episode. And after that, other composers did the score, but they always carried my theme throughout. So it just depended on which show it was, whether I did the whole thing or not.
Now, is it any coincidence that of all the television shows I listed, they were all on ABC?
Just a coincidence, yeah. I guess I was a fair-haired child at that point at ABC. But I think it had mostly to do with the fact that I was with, a lot of it came from Paramount. And, you know, but it really is a coincidence. I think about it. Wide World of Sports was ABC Monday Night Football, and then Love and American Style. But then when I did Happy Days, that was with Gary Marshall. And so I did a lot of those shows that he was with ABC. And the two other fellows, Tom Miller and Eddie Milkus, they produced the shows that Gary Marshall created. And then we went from Happy Days to spinoffs like Laverne and Shirley, a short-lived show called Pinky Tuscadero, or Blansky's Beauties.
Right.
A pilot that never sold called the Ralph and Potsy Show. So we kind of had a run on ABC. But I did other shows. The Paper Chase, I think, was CBS. And, you know, I've been involved with about 50 different television series altogether. Or shows. Not all of them series. Some of them just pilots.
Now, going forward to your book, which, again, the book is entitled Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music, what made you decide to do the memoir at this point? Why not earlier? Why not later?
Well, it came about as a result of finding letters in my mother's apartment that I had written when I was a student. I was 18, 19, 20 years old, I lived in Paris. And I was very fortunate at a young age to get to study with an extraordinary teacher, Nadia Boulanger, who was Aaron Copland's teacher 40 years before me. And I went to the Fontainebleau, France, the Palace of Fontainebleau, there's a conservatory, just for the summer when I was 18 years old. And she kind of took me under her wing, and she said, come to Paris and stay here and take lessons with me. And I used to see her at least 3-4 times a week for lessons. Private lessons, composition analysis, harmony classes, keyboard harmony classes. And she really took me under her wing. And frankly, she gave me a whole life in music. I stayed with her for 2 years. I mean, I stayed studying with her for 2 years in Paris. And while I was there, I wrote all these letters home. I couldn't afford to, I had no telephone, couldn't afford to make a phone call. So I wrote extensive letters home. And contrary to what people write now with on Twitter and emails, short little letters, I wrote long, extensive letters about my life in Paris. Someone referred to it as Paris in black and white, you know, 1959, 1960, and a lot about my teacher and being a student of hers. So when we found these letters in my mother's drawer that was hidden probably for 40 years in her apartment in the Bronx where I was born and raised, it sort of opened the portals back to my early years, and those letters, I got a call one day from a literary agent who said he heard about those letters through my son, who's a writer, and he said, can I see those letters? I said, gee, they're kind of personal, they're my letters, and he said, well, you know, it's 40 years later, and it just sounds so interesting, a young student studying about Nadia Boulanger in Paris. Anyway, he convinced me to send the letters, and then he called me back, excuse me, called me back a couple weeks later and said he really thinks that I should write my memoir with this as a cornerstone, that my life in music has been interesting starting with this. So I agreed to do it, you know, just that simple. And of course, the letters are largely reprinted. There's a censor section Not all the letters, of course, and not all the details. They're just too personal. You know, that would be boring, frankly, for people. How is this when they're asking about a certain uncle or a cousin? But it's a lot out in my life and as a young composer, learning how to compose music and with this fantastic teacher.
Were you surprised? Surprised that your mother had saved the letters?
I was. They were in a shoebox, Peter. They were found there. There were 200 letters, neatly put away, probably never seen again. You know, I was in Paris. My family's in the Bronx. And every letter started, dear family, you know, love, Charles. And it was my connection home for 2 years. And I was, as I say, 18, 19, 20 years old. We found that when we were clearing out my mother's apartment, about 2 or 3 years before she passed away, she was living with us in California. And we went to get the mementos out of the apartment, you know, the things that were significant to her, photographs. And in the dresser drawer, covered and not seen, was this shoebox. And so that is really what opened the door to my past. I really never thought about writing my memoir. It just kind of came out of me.
What do you think?
It's literary.
What do you think, because this book came out after your mother passed away, what do you think your mother would say or think about a book that you've written, a memoir that you've written, based on the letters you initially wrote to her?
It's a good question, Peter. I don't even know. I can't even begin to imagine. I'm sure she would have been proud of it. I'm sure she would have been. You know, my mother lived until she was like 96 years old, and she got to see a lot of my success. You know, she got to see my success. So she was very proud of you know, me and the music and everything. And she came to enjoy a lot of that. She came to San Francisco when my first ballet was premiered at the San Francisco Ballet Company, and you know, she saw my works on television and records and all that. As far as the letters, I don't know. I can't begin to imagine, except that she probably would have been tickled to see it in print, you know.
When you started writing this, and now that it's done and the book is now out, the book again is called Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music, who did you think your primary target audience would be? Who did you want to reach? The fan of music in general, or the budding composer? Whom?
You know, probably all the above and others. Certainly, I'd like people to read it who have their heart set on a dream that maybe they think is accomplishable or not. Someone who, you know, I was born and raised in the Bronx. People didn't aspire to be composers, you know. My father's a window cleaner. They supported me going to Paris and studying with the little money that they had. So I was very fortunate. I was able to go after my dreams, and what I set out is kind of a record of how that happened for me. It never happens. Just, you know, I teach at UCLA too. I teach composition, and when I speak to young people, it never happens twice the same way. But I would like people who aspire to do certain things, people who you know, need encouragement to pursue their whatever the world is. It doesn't have to be music; it can be anything.
One quick last question. What does your son, the writer, think of your book?
You know, I never wrote anything down before. This is my only literary achievement, if it's an achievement. He's very proud of it. He's proud of his dad, you know, and I'm of him. My son's written a lot of movies, and I have a whole wall of screenplays that he's written. So I think we're equally proud of each other. I know he enjoys the book and he's proud of it.
Well, for those of us, especially those of us who grew up in the 70s, it's always great to hear about some of the people who have affected our lives. And certainly the music that was done for television shows and also some pop songs are the soundtracks of our lives. So I'm glad you wrote the book and are sharing your story with the general public. And I thank you very much for being on the show with us.
My pleasure. And actually, I did write the book. A lot of people ask me about who wrote the book, and I say, no, I really did. I wrote it in longhand and long, you know, yellow pads. My assistant put it in the computer, and I made changes. But if anyone wants to know about it, if they went to my website, killingmesoftly.com, there are samples of, you know, pages and stories about it. Roberta Flack wrote a beautiful foreword for me, which is on my webpage as well, and just a lot of really notable, wonderful people in the music business wrote things for me on the book. And so I'm really proud of it, and I'm happy that I get a chance to share it with other people.
Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
Composer Charles Fox, author of Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. You can check out his website at killingmesoftly.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0060. And you can find links to Charles's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're getting dangerously close to the very end of this edition of The Stuff File program, and you know what that means. Yes, it means it's time for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Mark Smith, age 59, was arrested at a bank in Watsonville, California in September after he had allegedly threatened a teller with a bomb. And by the way, he spelt bomb, B-O-M, and demanded $2,000. The teller, apparently skeptical of Smith's toughness and probably his intelligence, tried to convince him instead to borrow the money, and she had him wait while she retrieved an application, during which time, of course, she called 911. By the time police arrived, Smith was filling out a loan application. Yeesh. Why would someone who actually walks into a bank with the aim of robbing it actually fill out an application for a loan? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that number is 0060. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and at Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJMedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national carrier China Airlines for their long-haul dynasty flights, and also over the air on World FM 88.2 in New Zealand and Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.